When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
I got another question via the form at baronvonbear.com/AMA, as in ask me anything. And by the way, yes, I'm recording on the road, but my both hands are on the wheel. I'm being safe. And in the spirit of being safe, I'm not going to read the question verbatim because I'm keeping my eyes on the road. The question revolved around this idea of how a lot of media creators for children's properties have children and cite their children as a source of inspiration for their work, and ask the question, do I feel that my work suffers because I have not raised children? Now, that I remember getting caught in that word, I have not raised children. I think that's an important distinction to make here, and because I think that it's a fair question. I don't have children. As I've explored in some past Thunder Punch Dailies, I am the second oldest of seven. So I did kind of raise my siblings, but I was very young. You know, I mean, I remember changing diapers as a young kid, and I remember, you know, helping with the childcare. But I wasn't a father to them, right? I was an older sibling. So, and in the context that a father has, and for all you fathers out there, I imagine it's a frightening experience that you largely feel lost and adrift in, and you're making it up as you go along. I get that. But, you know, as a 10-year-old, I had much, much less context, and also, you know, while I felt a strong sense of responsibility, I still had parents. So, yeah, I'm missing out on a key experience that a lot of other human beings get. And I think that's worth acknowledging. But as I think about it, something that feels very obvious to me in my work, and I can't tell you if this was obvious to me my entire career as a cartoonist, but recently as I think about it, it just seems absolutely obvious that part of the job of being an author, cartoonist, whatever you want to call it, a storyteller, is perspective taking. Thinking about what it's like being in the character's shoes so that I'm not just writing a interpretation of what I think that character would think and do. Now, what I mean is, and I think I talked about this in some recent Thunder Punch dailies as well, is this idea that, like, after the 2016 election, the assignment that I gave the students was thinking about our interdependency. Let's do a mini comic. Let's make a mini comic where we take the position of somebody we absolutely disagree with. We don't have to agree with them, but we have to try to see the world through their eyes. That was partially me trying to use my power as a teaching artist to help younger people think more compassionately. But it was also to help them understand that the skill of a storyteller, a chief skill of the storyteller, is understanding all the positions of the characters. Now, why am I driving at this? I also think about perspective taking in terms of the stuff I make for the audience that it's intended for. So, a project that I think is very a clear example of this is the Captain Seriously comic series that I created over the last decade. Just finished up my work on that, making a comic for every grade in a southeast Michigan school district for grades 2 through 10. And obviously, if the comics are going to be given to that wide of an age range, there's going to be a lot of differences in the storytelling. I'm obviously not going to tell the same kind of story to a 10th grader that I tell to a second grader. And in this project, I was fortunate in that I had the support of the school district, where they actually made time for me to meet with administration and teachers to talk about the problems that these different grades are encountering, right? What is a specific thing you wish you had some support on in your classroom in terms of social and emotional learning. What's something that you see the students struggling with right now? Right. So that's getting their perspective as somebody who's working directly with the kids. But then also, I, as the cartoonist writing the stories, thought about what I was experiencing at that age. What was seventh grade like for me? Now, I know that there's going to be differences. When I was in seventh grade, it was 1987, right? The media world was a lot different. We didn't have these little glass slabs in our pockets that gave us access to the entire world. So, of course, things are different. But certain things, I think, are relatively the same, right? So, like, when I think about taking perspective of seventh grade, not revealing anything about myself was of utmost importance. Letting anybody know how terrified I was and how much I wanted to belong, how desperately I wanted to belong, playing that hand, showing my cards on that, as it were, was, it felt absolutely dangerous. And when I think about that, I think about how these post-apocalyptic books for young adults, like Hunger Games and the Divergent series, kind of raised that anxiety to, through metaphor, to this like apocalyptic level. And I think that's why they land with that audience, is because it's kind of it's describing how the world feels to that age range, or kids, a majority of kids in at that age, right? Not a majority, a certain number, let's just say that. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of perspective taking. I also take the perspective of the young person who's going to be reading my book. And this is informed by me remembering my childhood. I remember what it's like to be a kid. I spend a lot of time thinking about what it was like when I was a kid. But also, I work with children. I work with ages 9 through 18 on a fairly regular basis. And I get inspiration from them, not just in terms of how, you know, like a lot of people will say this, like you put a pencil in or a crayon in the hand of a 9-year-old and they're all artists, right? They all have a bottomless well of inspiration, and they don't have a filter, and they no idea feels too silly for them, right? And so you can get like these wonderfully whimsical kinds of combinations of ideas and expressions from them. Sure. But there's other things I get out of working with kids and thinking about my own childhood that I think about, like how, what would be one thing? When I think about my perspective as a young person, I felt like I had a sense of when somebody was trying to sell me a bill of goods because it was quote unquote good for me, and when they were trying to get me to sign on to something because they knew I would have a good time. This is going to be fun for you. You're going to enjoy this. Versus, do this because this is a good thing for you to do. A good example of this is, I think of two different teachers I had in high school. My algebra teacher was very much in the camp of, I'm an adult, you're a child, you're going to do what I say, and by the way, you'll thank me later for this, right? And then And I actually failed Algebra 2. I flunked it. I got an F. Ruined my grade point average. I was really striving for that 4.0, but I think I graduated with a 3.75 in that algebra class. That bummer. Anyway, but then geometry, I took geometry. Now part of it is the subject matter. Algebra is kind of an abstract thing, and geometry, I think, for somebody who thinks like me, visually and spatially, but also like I remember geometry class largely being about logic. I got A pluses in that, but I think part of it had to do with the fact that the teacher really seemed to care about the material and had a sense of joy about it, a real sense of enthusiasm and excitement. He didn't call them tests, he called them games, which kind of feels silly, and like adults kind of being like, you know, haha, I know this is really suffering, but we're going to call it something pleasant so it doesn't feel like suffering. Look, it's not poison, it's cake. I'm calling it cake. It's still poison, right? You could easily roll your eyes at that, him calling test games, and a lot of my fellow students did. But what I received from that was, he was saying, like, isn't this awesome? This stuff is so awesome. I love it so much. And I couldn't help but kind of like it, partly because of his enthusiasm around it. And so I think about that in my work, is that I don't want to, I don't ever want to preach to children. I don't want to sit down crisscross applesauce and say, gather on, children, I'm about to give you something that is wholesome and meaningful and will support you. I want that to be in there. But the main thing is I want them to have a good time. I don't want the vitamins to get in the way of the sugar. I don't really like that metaphor very much, but I hope you understand where I'm getting at here. Is like that's something I've learned about working with children and thinking about my own experiences. Like, so I think, okay, here's a better metaphor. When I'm teaching in the classroom, I never say, all right, everybody, calm down. We got to get this work done today. If the energy is moving in a way where what we're attending to doesn't seem to be filling them with life energy, they don't seem enlivened by what's happening, we'll change gears. What else can we do with what we got today? What can we do? How can we find something that is meaningful, purposeful, and, you know, helps equip you with the skills that you came here to learn that's not this? It's more than just keeping it fun. It's really, for me, it's about like meeting them where they are at their energy level. And now when you're making art that is going to be consumed in a variety of scenarios and a variety of times, you don't know how they're going to meet the work. You obviously can't do that. But that's a spirit that I like to keep in mind. It's like, how is a kid going to feel about what I'm showing right now? Like, so for instance, there's a character in Baron von Baron, the Case of the Two-Faced Statue, called the Living Doll. And this character's in there because as a child, I was very frightened of dolls. I still find them creepy, and I think most people do. I don't think I'm special in this regard. It's like if I say to you, oh, you're going to stay at a bed and breakfast, and by the way, you get the doll suite, and you're in this bed surrounded by a bunch of curio cabinets with 1800s dolls with those creepy glass eyes that close when you lay the doll down, you know? Most of us are going to be freaked out by that. Not all of us, but most of us will. Also, ventriloquist dummies. I got a real big problem with ventriloquist dummies. I think they are creepy beyond all reason. So I knew that I wanted one of the monsters in the book to be some kind of doll. And it took me a few tries to land on an image of an animal sort of doll that gives me the same kind of creepy vibes. But then I thought about it. I'm like, well, is this too much? Am I putting in something that will visually overwhelm a child where they close the book and don't want to go on? And then here we get into that perspective taking again. I think about my relationship with scary stories as a child. And something I think that is, and I've talked with enough other people about this, that I think it's something that is not universal, but it's fairly common amongst children at a certain age. Like when you get to be like 12, you get intrigued by the scary story, and it becomes overwhelming at times. You're like, oh, that's too much. I got to look away from it. I got to cover my eyes, or I got to close the book or whatever. But you kind of want to know how it all goes, right? You're gravitated toward it and you're repelled by it at the same time. And not only do I talk about this with friends who grew up around the same time that I did, but I talk about this with my students. You know, when I'm teaching 12-year-olds, we'll talk about scary stories and we'll talk about monsters, and I'll ask them, like, what's your experience like? What's your favorite scary movie right now? Oh, we love the Annabelle movies. Really? Annabelle? I find them too scary. Tell me what you like about them. What's your favorite part? What's your least favorite part? When did you cover your eyes? Did you cover your eyes? Right? So I guess that's another element of this, is that as somebody who's privileged to get to work with children, one thing that I try to never lose sight of is a sense of curiosity about them, and not just, you know, how to describe my line of questioning. I do my best to take the perspective of being a young person, right? When I talk with my students, I'll say, like, how was your week? And they'll just go, good. And I'm like, okay, yes, you gave me the answer that you give adults when they ask you a question like that. Now really tell me, how was your week? Tell me something that was awesome. Tell me something that was really a drag, right? And I try to think about that when I'm asking them about the media that they consume. Like, well, tell me about the, like a thing that's really cool about it. Tell me one thing that like is kind of like you wish was better. Tell me one thing where you were confused. Why would I want to go see this thing? Why would I want to watch this movie? Why would I want to play this game? Right? And that's partially to get them thinking analytically as students. Like, what is it that's moving me about this thing? And how can I mine that idea for my own work? But it's also, it's a reciprocal deal. Because then I get to, like, hear about their perspective and what it is attracting them to that thing. And then I can compare it to my perspective as a child, what I think my perspective was as a child. And I can start to put together, like, a little persona in my head of, I think this is how the reader that I'm writing this for is going to see the world, how they see the world, and how they will receive the images that I'm putting in this book and the messages that I'm putting in this book. So, did I miss out on something by not raising children? Probably. But I think I've sort of made up for the difference in my own way by really staying in touch with my younger self, or at least the image of my younger self, and working with children in a way that in which I'm joyfully celebrating each and every one of them for their individual self. I think this is something I talk about in my classrooms all the time, is like, you know, a question I always get, I'm actually going somewhere with this. A question I often get from students when I do school visits is, do you know anybody famous? Which is like, oh, ouch. I'm not famous enough that you gotta ask me like name drops of people who you actually want to hear about? Man, kids, you don't pull any punches. But I turn that into a teachable moment in my presentations, where I have when I get asked that question, I've got 5 or 6 slides of me with much more famous cartoonists when hanging out at festivals. Like, it's always like us just hanging out and having a good time. It's never me like standing next to them and, you know, getting your picture taken next to the celebrity. It's more like, here I am having ice cream with this particular author. Here I am, you know, and you hear all the gasps. Oh my gosh, he knows all these famous people. And I go, yeah, you know what that means? That means that the comics world is very small. Once you start making books, you start meeting all the people. And if you're a jerk, word gets around, we all talk. And so there's a very practical reason for being a kind person. It means that you get to work more and people want to be around you. So then I go through my, you know, 3 rules of being in the comics tribe, but I won't go into that here. I've gone into that in other places. My point is that similarly, by joyfully celebrating each of these students for being the unique individual that they are, it's given me the net benefit of having a bunch of different perspectives that I can go back to and think about when I'm making my stories for young people. Once again, only speaking for me. I can only speak for myself on this thing, and I'm not trying to indoctrinate anybody. I'm not trying to tell anybody else how to live their lives, but something that's very crucial to me is having a sense of being able to take the perspective of another person. One, because I think it makes me a more compassionate human being. But I also think it makes my characters resonate more. One of the greatest gifts a cartoonist once said to me, a cartoonist that I had like just bags of respect for, still do. But he said that one thing that really stands out about my work is that my character voices really feel authentic and true to that character. And I'm really grateful for that. And I think that if that's true, it's because I think hard about, like, well, when I want them to talk, I want them to be speaking from a place that I can understand, if not agree with. So the villain in the book is Gallus Lugubrious, this chicken sorcerer. And he is very hostile toward Baron Von Behr. One, because Baron Von Behr has this device called the Stone Guardian that Gallus wants really badly, so there's like a bit of a greedy child thing going on with him. But that's not enough. It can't just be like, oh, he's got the thing I want, so I hate him. I wanted him to like despise Baron Von Behr on like some kind of like deep fundamental level. And so I thought, well, what is he what's his Jungian shadow, right? Jungian shadow is like the thing that you won't allow yourself to be. The poet Robert Bly talks about this. The thing that as a child you put in a bag and you're dragging it behind you, you don't know it's there, right? It's the thing that, you know, either the society or yourself told you it's shameful to do that thing, don't do it anymore. And so I thought, okay, well, he's a sorcerer, he's a practitioner, he's somebody who actually, like, uses magic in the world. So he hates Baron von Baer because he's a scholar, because he's a person who stays holed up and just studies, doesn't actually use any of the things. He's sitting on top of this treasure of dangerous magical objects, and he won't actually employ them to make the world a quote-unquote better place, right? Well, what's the better place that Gallus Lugubrious wants to make? Maybe we don't even need to go into it, because maybe he doesn't even know. All that matters is that he believes that things are meant to be used, and to put them on a shelf and to dust them and to write a book about them is not a noble task. That's something that cowards and useless people do. So I'm not saying I agree with him. I'm just saying that I've thought about what his perspective is. So now when I'm writing his character in the book, I can speak from a natural place so that it feels consistent and it doesn't feel contrived. I think I did a good job of it in the book. Which is to say, if this essay was at all intriguing to you, if you like the way I think about things, then I think you'll like the book. BaronVonBaer.com is where you can find out more information. You can pre-order, you can join the mailing list, you can read more about the characters and see some sample pages. And if you want to ask more thoughtful questions or wonderings to get me to do another essay, you know, something you're wondering about, baronvonbaer.com/AMA, as in ask me anything. So thank you for supporting me in this project. Thank you for checking out the book. And until next time, remember, everybody,
it's a good thing Orko got my sword back today, or Prince Adam might never have been seen again. The rock man who took my sword thought it made him a leader, but he was wrong. A sword or any other symbol doesn't make a person a good leader. What does is intelligence, respect for others, and an unselfish desire to do good. People are proud of a leader with those qualities, so if you develop them in yourself, you could become a good leader too. See you soon.